is the Saturday Supplement. I'm Frank Lewis. Today, travelling to poet Paddy Bush's special places based on his book, The Amargan Step, subtitled An Exploration in the Imagination of Ivara. Guided by Paddy, over the first hour, we'll visit the 4,000-year-old wedge tomb at Cumhuchiste at the edge of a huge panorama. The ancients believed the arch through the Bull Rock was the passage to another world. Killabona, a place of pilgrimage where a community of nuns lived, with a huge panorama over St Finian's Bay to the Skellig. And first, looking out at Carrigena, a small bare rock outcrop on Ballinskellig's Bay, a place mentioned in the first great poem of Ireland, The Song of Amargan. Today's programme is recorded on April the 29th. For future programmes, your story on Paddy Bush's special places, his exploration in the imagination of Ivara. Write Frank Lewis, Killarney, Mangerton Road, Muckross, Killarney. Email franklewismangerton@gmail.com. Text 083-300-3300 or phone 066-712-3666 with your name and address for use on air. To begin, as I've said, we're in the back garden of the Bush home on the Ballinskellig's Bay shore. The road in water, we're looking out at the huge expanse of Ballinskellig's Bay, and out there, less than a kilometre offshore, the tiny bare rock outcrop, Carrigona. We're joined by Paddy's son, Enya Bush. Paddy, why is Carrigona important in your explanation or exploration in the imagination of Ivara?
Well, I suppose firstly and primarily because it's just off my back garden, out from my windows. You can judge the weather from it. But also because it was through Carrigena that I found my way into the Amargan story and the Milesian story. Cruhuro Cronin, the principal of the vocational school, when I came teaching here in 1973, explained the name to me and traced it to a 17th century poem by Sean O'Connell. A taig bun Quran foscum trech and carigler kaila gushachla chéna, and that really started me exploring that story and adding layer and layer to it. But that was the physical presence of the story I looked out at every day.
Yeah, Enya, I mean it's a wonderful panorama. We're looking out Hog's Head at the southern end, I suppose, and Bola's Head on the northern side, and Carrigena in between. Enya, when you think of Carrigena, a very graphic, personal memory comes to mind.
My father told me the story how Aina, Amargan's brother, perished on that rock.
You had a particular memory, though, early on your way out as a young man with your sister and your father.
That's right. We were out fishing for mackerel, as we used to do in my younger days. And I remember my sister, Kirin, hooking into a small shark and a big panic on the boat until Paddy jumped up and cut the line. So, yeah, that's pretty vivid, all right. I'm quite sure we were very safe, but in my young mind, it was terrible peril altogether.
Paddy, Carrigena shows climate change, which is very personal for you.
Well, it's the surrounding area, really, as much as Carrigena. You can see the height of waves and things, but where we're standing here, you know, there was always a certain amount of natural erosion. The erosion now is increasing the rate at which it's happening, so that, you know, the eventual disappearance of the house, instead of being something that's in the way, way distant future, could be seen in, you know, 3 or 4 bad years.
Enya, in recent years, rowing a kayak on Ballinskellig, experiencing nature.
Over the years, there's been a big colony of seals building up on the rock, and Paddy and myself and my nephew, Paddy's grandson, went out for a kayak there in a lovely summery day like this. And it was just, it's just so magical to see the seal pups swimming around you and darting up and down and standing up on the rock and looking in on the shore. It's just a very magical place.
Paddy, the name Carrigena, as you've said, goes back to our first invaders. What about 100 years ago was it the great storyteller Sean O'Connell told about Carrigena?
In the Leabhar Gaoil, they talk about Éireannán drowning when the boat hit a rock. Sean O'Connell, the poet in the 17th century, and then Sean O'Connell, the Seanchaí, in the early part of the 20th century, both that name seems to have been transformed to Éanna, and they talk about one of the Milesians drowning on that particular rock.
Enya, a story that sums up the experience of making a film on one of Paddy's collections of poems.
Oh, yes, he had a book, My Lord Buddha of Carrigena, and we made films of, I'm not sure Paddy was at all the poems, but quite a few poems in that collection, and obviously the rock played a huge part in that. We went out in boats and kayaks and we were doing underwater shots and overwater things and all that.
Paddy, the snorting of seals, the flurry of oyster catchers, cormorants croaking, so many aspects of living nature here.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm no naturalist. You know, I don't know anything academic or specialist about the nesting habits of birds or even their types. But, you know, I love watching oyster catchers, seals, ravens nesting in the cliff, which you can sometimes see the young chicks with their red throats open for food. And it's easy to be close to it here. And when I was writing The American Steppe, a lot of that was done during COVID. And, you know, COVID, as happened with so many people, pushed us into being closer to nature rather than choice. And that was a big help, and I hope it has stayed with me.
Enya, as a youngster, again, you mentioned earlier, sitting for hours watching waves crashing over Carrigena.
Well, I do remember the day that I was looking out and there was a particular big storm and waves, as I said, we were going 50, 60 feet up in the air, and I've always loved looking at that. But I do remember the day of Paddy explaining that that's the place I got my name from and that my predecessor, I suppose you'd call him, drowned out in the rock and all that. And it's just something that's obviously stuck with me. The rock, as I said, it's just physically, it's always just there. If you want to go for a walk on one of the other beaches, you'd look out at the rock to check, was the tide in or out? If you wanted to go fishing and you'd be checking the tide, or you'd check what way the swell of the waves was around the rock. It's just always something that's been part of living here, when I was living here, and even visiting, it's always something you just have a look at.
Yeah, I should maybe mention when my mother's reaction when I said our then new baby was being called Anna, and she said, "Where did you get that?" And I said, "From Carrigena, just offshore." And she sniffed, as only my mother could sniff, and said, "I've heard of children being called after relations or after saints, never after a rock."
Is there a particular reaction in your view to the book, to The American Steppe?
I'm always very proud of Paddy's work and the amount of effort he puts into it. That came out at what was a very difficult time for him in his own life with his health and whatever. So just, it's something that you just see how much effort and passion he puts into things. So you'd be really just delighted for him and proud of him when they come to fruition. Then,
Paddy, I suppose we should finish this first section, the Song of Amargan, the prayer. Similar to the prayer of Patrick in many ways, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And it's also, similarities have been pointed out to Indian poems, the Bhagavad Gita, if I pronounce it properly, Shiva's song in that. It's a common sort of motif, this identification with nature. It said that literally he set his right foot on the land and said, you know, the medieval Irish said, "Tubert a chushe deshi in Éirinn," and he came out with this. So that was his statement of ownership or identification. "I'm wind on sea, I'm wave swelling, I'm ocean's voice, I'm stag of seven clashes, I'm falcon on cliff, I'm sunlit dewdrop, I'm rarest of herbs, I'm boar enraged, I'm salmon in pool, I'm lake in plain, I'm fortified hilltop, I'm learning's essence, I'm sharpened spear dealing death, I'm God who kindles fire in the head. Who makes smooth the stony mountain? Who elucidates the lives of the moon? Who proclaims where the sun will rest? Who leads the stars like cattle from the ocean? On whom do those stars smile? What troop, what god edges blades in a plague-struck fortress? I invoke a poet, poet of wind." It was almost like an ecological manifesto. You know, we are these. He was speaking for his people. We are these things. These things are us. We must not hurt ourselves.
Enya, thanks for talking to us.
You're welcome, Frank. Thank you.
And the boys of a Bognes Loidu, who hunted farther and
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shop and Seafood Bar, the Mall Tralee. Treat yourself to the freshest takeaway fish and chips today, right in the heart of Tralee.
And the boys of a Bognesloy do, oh, hunted farther and.
In our journey to Paddy Bush's special places, guided by his book, The Amargan Step, we're now joined by the archaeological master of Iveragh, John Sheehan, at the 4,000-year-old Bronze Age Cumhachaisteu wedge tomb. Paddy, describe what we're looking at.
Well, the wedge tomb itself, you've a large slab on a number of uprights, but it's the sighting of this place that always excites me. It's liminality, its sense of borderness. You know, if we had come up from the Waterville side, you'd see one landscape and seascape. And then as soon as you crossed over the ridge close by, you'd be in a totally different place. It's looking down at the Bull Rock, which was the pre-Christian other world. It is a view out over the islands and particularly over Scariff. And it's, you know, very much borderline. And when, you know, the O'Connell was returning in 1828 after the Clare election triumph, and folklore, and that's all it is, there's no written record of it, but folklore collected in the late 19th century says that the people of Derrynane came up here to greet him, that Tomás Rua composed Siadónal Bean O'Connell Queen for it, and this sort of natural amphitheatre with a natural platform here, if you like, would have been the ideal thing for that to happen. But this is conjecture.
John, you say this wedge tomb at Cumhachaisteu and the other wedge tombs around Ballinskerrig's Bay are the oldest archaeological monuments in Iveragh, built by Milesians, the first inhabitants of Iveragh, some 4,000 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, they are the first visible monuments that you have in South Kerry. In other parts of Ireland, you had passage graves and portal tombs and other forms of megaliths, but you don't get those in South Kerry. You get the wedge tombs and plenty of them. So it's the first time you see sort of monumental archaeology in South Kerry, the time of the wedge tombs. And we know from excavations in various places in Munster that the date of these is about 2500 BC. So they're 4,500 years old. And what I think is that around that time, around 2500, the population of Iveragh was beginning to grow and different population groups were carving out their own territories. So in some ways what this is, it's more than just a tomb. A tomb is where we bury the dead. When we excavate these, normally there's only one or two cremations in them, so it's not a major burial site. Instead, it's a sort of a political statement, a statement of identity. You're leaving one territorial group back there, and you're now entering into this group, and this is our monument, and maybe even the bones in there are the bones of the founding fathers of this new settlement.
Paddy, as you were saying a minute ago, we're looking out on as well as Scariff and Deanish and the Bull, the Cow and the Calf, and Dursey Island and the whole of the Bear down below is Kenmare Bay. Dahi O'Hogan, telling about the arched window, the portal through the Bull Rock, Teck Dún, was a passage, as you said, to another world. Going through it with Donald Lynch, I remember a couple of years ago, I was relieved to be at the other side.
Yeah, I've gone through it twice, I think, and it's an overwhelming experience. It's terrifying, not in the sense that you think you're in any immediate danger, but when you realise the power of nature, the weightiness, what could happen if things went wrong, and combine that with the passageway element in it. It's a very overwhelming experience. Mm. And, you know, I think it's part of what you experience when you're here. Mm. At this tomb. And you mentioned Scariff there. If O'Connell did speak here, he would have been very aware of the story of Brath Aru and the Scariffa, who was beheaded there by Cromwellian troops in, I forget, 1640 something. Yeah. And, you know, whose skull is now in Killarney. And that skull was in the possession of the O'Connells. It was sort of family thing on which they swore oaths. So history, real and imaginary, would have surrounded him when he was here.
Going back to the Bull Rock for a second, though, I mean, you write, the departing spirits of the dead followed the course of the sun as it passed under the archway into the sea and there to the other world. Paddy, you say it's necessary to rediscover story and myth in our surroundings, to animate, perhaps reanimate the place we live. Why?
Because the world is in an ecological crisis. Even on radio this morning, they were talking about, you know, that it's close to tipping point. We tend to see that, I think, in scientific terms, which are very important and are basic to the thing. But I think if you are to care about a place, you need to have an imaginative and creative relationship with it, that it's not a collection of biology or zoology or any other ology only, that it's the imaginative relationship with it going back thousands of years. And I think, you know, to love a place, to feel for it so that you'll feel the human race is being wounded if you wound that place, we need to know how previous generations have felt about place.
Paddy, in his poetry, though, over a long number of years now, has been leading or certainly contributing significantly to all of that.
No, absolutely. Paddy published a collection of poetry quite a while ago now called To Make the Stone Sing. And it was only recently I pulled it off the shelf and I was browsing through it. And I was thinking about the title, which comes from one of the poems within. It's actually a poem about the fiddler stone out on Inishusil, close enough to us here in Loch Ron. And what Paddy does with his poetry when he writes about archaeological sites is he does what theoretical archaeologists and landscape archaeologists try to do. They're looking for the bigger picture. What is this monument telling us? Except Paddy does it poetically, he does it beautifully, and he makes the stone sing.
Paddy, as you were saying, I mean, here this gathering and what O'Connell had done in Clare in 1828 and the whole, as you describe it, it was a political earthquake, the first evidence of people power.
Yeah, and this would have been, you know, a relatively minor gathering compared to the monster meetings that developed recently. But it, you know, O'Connell had been agitating, writing letters, campaigning for emancipation for, you know, 20 years before that. This was the first real tangible thing. Even Robert Peel wrote, you know, all the great alliances broke down. You know, it was an earthquake, not only in Ireland, but, you know, in Britain as well.
Just going back to Paddy's theory that it was on this tomb that Daniel O'Connell stood in 1828 to address the local people who had come up to welcome him. When I read that, when his book came out last year, and I read that, what came to mind for me, and probably it's because I'm a Westmeath man, was the Hill of Uisneach in 1926, when another great political leader, this time it was Éamon de Valera, and it was the year he was trying to found his party, Fianna Fáil, he held a meeting on the Hill of Uisneach, and he stood on Alt na Mirren, the capstone on the Hill of Uisneach, and there's a fantastic photograph that survives of him standing there addressing the people.
Welcoming O'Connell home in 1828 after he won the Clare by-election and Catholic emancipation. To sing us out, Tim Dennehy sings Tomás Ruaidh Sulawán's Donal Bean, O'Connell Keane, which Paddy was first recited here.
She Donal Bean O'Connell Queen on the plough the field on the rail go le fiaw se fin is se miaw rechin the skol she she some cres locht go vel she shgrifa vi bals dorina go mafar a kis to rail il sgo meg na fire gi brak lef li tang tacht ish dachar fwin tech le ram and right fall the dal dal right fall the dal dal right fall all the dal the dairy.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry, brought to you by Quinlan's The Mad Monk in Killarney, serving the finest seafood in a cosy modern atmosphere. Book your special experience today at seafoodbar.ie.
And the boys of a Bognes Loidu hunted farther and...
Continuing our visitation to Paddy Bush's special places, based on his exploration in the imagination of Ivara, the Amargan Step, recorded on April 29th, your take on Paddy's places and his take on them. For future programmes, text 083 300 3300 or phone 066 7123666. We're now in Kilaboyne. The site is associated with St. Boyne, who is locally reputed to have been a sister of St. Patrick. It has also been suggested that the site was founded by St. Brendan or by St. Bionis, Brendan's disciple. My earliest memory being told it was a convent and the great number of crosses carved into the stones here. Permission to survey the site during the time of the archaeological survey was refused. Here we're joined by Kenmare-based archaeologist Frank Coyne. Paddy, another huge panorama from here.
There is an extraordinary panorama and one of historical interest or time, as well as physically extraordinarily beautiful. Skellig and Little Skellig merge into one out on the horizon. And, you know, you can also see through a gap in the hills called Beloch na Gael over to where there's a similar site in Loher with a perspective on Skellig.
Frank, we're looking at little more than a scattering, well, it's more than a scattering of stones that you could see on almost any part of any hillside here. Frank, the significance of this site?
I suppose one of the main aspects of this is the sheer size of it. When you come up here first, it looks like it's just a collection of stones, stone huts. But then when you've looked at it in detail, as has been done over the years since the early 1900s, and then back in 2015 when I surveyed it myself, I find it stretches over several hundred metres. And it stretches off to the north, where there's an enclosure, there's hut sites, until you get to the main part of the site, which is here on another terrace. And the terracing itself is important because there are very limited amount of sites like this, and the closest one being the Skelligs that we're looking out on. So here, standing today, we have a cross slab, we have a stone cross, we have an oratory, and we have a gable or a tent shrine, we have a holy well, and we have various huts stretching off down along the hillside. So over the course of maybe 300 metres, we have all these significant sites all in one area. If you wanted to go and see all these, you'd have to go to several sites to get a flavour of all these. Here, you have them all in one place, looking out over the Skelligs.
Yeah. Paddy, after many years of climbing up here, I'm quoting you, I've gradually come to absorb it as a place of pilgrimage and as, in a literal sense, a place of vision, which I, an atheist, find more and more moving as time goes by. Paddy, I'm quoting your words. Moving in what way?
Well, it's what I said in a different context to you. For me, spirituality, whether it's religiously based or not, involves shifting your mind, shifting your imagination into that of other people or other ways of looking at things. You know, as I said, I'm an atheist, but I am very moved by what I see as a claiming of a particular landscape in the name of a particular belief. You have literally a triangulation between the Skellig, where we are here, and Loher. And it's almost as if the monks who set up this place were saying, this is Christ's territory, we want to mark it as such.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to pick one site as a cornerstone for your work over the years, it probably would be the Skellig.
Yes.
I would think. And I mean, for somebody, the whole significance of the site there was extraordinary.
It is extraordinary, but the Skellig would have depended too on a main headquarters, if you like, a home farm on the mainland. And I think Frank would agree that this would at least make a good case for being such a place. It's a little bit inland from what would have been the closest sheltered landing point for the Skellig down at the Glen Pier.
You would have had to have one, if not more, places servicing the Skelligs. And while there's other good candidates, there's nothing of this size. This looks right out over the Skelligs. It's a perfect place. We don't know how they operated. Did they spend some time on? Did they come off? Did they swap? But it certainly would have taken a lot of manpower to build what we have here today. Now, we do know that this was occupied from our excavations over several hundred years, just like it was in the Skellig. So probably contemporary all the time. So why not?
What was the most important aspect of your archaeological and conservation work here?
Well, there were several different important events because, like all archaeological sites, the more you start to explore, the more the questions need to be answered. So Michael Connolly did work and excavation on the tent shrine, the gable shrine, and we've found that that's in its original location. That needed to be conserved before it fell. And then over the years, we did a conservation management plan, and then we did two phases of excavation work here. Very limited work as we were doing conservation work. And it does look like we're not just looking at a contemporary site with the Skelligs. We're also looking at a later phase of activity here relating to the Holy Well. Now, the Holy Well is important in that, as Paddy has said, there's a spiritual aspect to it, but also as an archaeologist, there's a practical aspect to it. So why did they come up here? Well, the well today, you can't really get into it. When you do, it's completely sodden. But that turns into a very swift flowing stream
only 200 metres down and was a vital source of spring water that gushes out of the earth. Now, because it's been overgrown, it's made the ground very sodden and you don't get that experience. But if we came up the other way, we were going to come up before the bull and the cattle got in the way, we would see a big gouge taken out of the landscape by that stream. So you had a combination of the holy well bringing people there. Then possibly in after the medieval period, when these fell out of use, maybe the Skelligs in the 12th century, and similarly here they moved over to Ballinskelligs, there was a revival in the Counter-Reformation for veneration at holy wells. And the penal laws tried to stamp that out. And it looks to us like they gathered up some of the monuments, replaced them beside the shrine to develop this area for the Pattern Days. Now, unfortunately, we don't know the Pattern Day for this site.
I think it's worth saying, you know, Frank has done terrific work here over a number of seasons, that the initiative for that originally came from the community here, Gerardet I Cineda, began a push for it, and Co-Coistive Rahig then got in touch with Mick Connolly, put us in touch with the scheme and so forth.
Paddy, surfers come in search of a wave because of a curse imposed in early medieval times by St. Finan.
Finan, according to the folklore, was coming in from Skellig, and a particularly nasty wave turned the curragh and his sandal was wet. The sandal was very important to Finan as part of his kingship association with the McCarthys. But he turned to the wave and he said, "Tán briste go bráth anot," there will be a broken wave in you forever. And the broken wave is there, and surfers love it, even when they haven't a clue where it came from.
Frank, it appears that the site at Kilabona was rearranged in the last few hundred years.
Indeed, yeah. From our work over the last few years, we have found now our work is limited to keyhole excavations as we're carrying out our conservation work. The reason we're here first is because the main terrace had collapsed in two places. So we came to put that back together, and we found that that was an outer leaf of a wall, possibly built to extend the area around the shrine to allow pilgrims to do the rounds of the shrine itself. And then the last bit of work we did, we found that the entire terrace has been raised by about a metre, and it looks like a huge hut site or clahan has been levelled, because we found the hanging eye, or the stone with the hole in it that would have held the hinge for the door, is in there. So it looks like the cross pillar is only put into that later material. So we think that all that material was gathered up to create the terrace and do the rounds of the well. We have a coin from 1927 from some of the field that was obviously just put in there as a votive offering. We have medieval pottery from the 13th to 14th century. So it could have happened any time from the 12th century, 13th century, right on to maybe the 17th, 18th century.
Yeah. Frank, you made pilgrimages and holy wells. What drove people to visit these sites?
Well, pilgrimage, it's a very curious phenomenon. It's known throughout all cultures and all religions, and there's different meanings for each religion. In its simplest form, it's an undertaking you do maybe to make restitution for some ill that you did. Sometimes it's done just for the glory of God.
Frank, you make the point about this whole area, the overall medieval characteristics of the glen.
Yeah, when we carried out the conservation management plan, we looked at what we call the zone of influence, and we decided to count up all the monuments in the glen, and there is an overwhelming early medieval character to this. There's four or five early ecclesiastical sites. There's a smaller version of this just down the hill with a smaller oratory, which may very well, if you think that there was nuns here, it may have been a female foundation just down the hill. We have a beautiful stone church, a galerous type, at the bottom of the valley. And we have ring forts. The character here is decidedly early medieval. So this would have been a very, very busy and very important place, which is hard to reconcile, I suppose, when we think that these foundations were meant to be, they're following the Desert Fathers and they were looking for isolation. Well, you can be isolated and also among lots of people as you were then. So I think this site fits in perfectly, an early medieval signature to the whole valley. It's almost like it's one community of that particular time, yeah, all focused out on the Skelligs. Yeah.
Frank Kine, thanks indeed for joining us.
And the boys of a Bognes Loide, who hunted farther and...
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars, located across the county. Serving the freshest seafood to Kerry families since 1963.
And the boys of a Bognes Loide, who hunted farther and...
in our quest for Paddy Bush's special places based on his very stimulating exploration in the imagination of Ivara, the Amargan Step. We're now at Tubberinnan, Fionnán's Well, where we're joined by Tom O'Shea. We're beside, as I said, Fionnán's Well and the O'Shea family farmhouse, which is over 300 years old. Pilgrimage here on the 15th and 16th of March, three shorter inner circuits of the well and six longer outer circuits, saying a complete rosary on each circuit. You gather nine pebbles before starting and drop one into a little heap after each round. Paddy, you say, this is the place I am most likely to encounter Fionnán.
Yeah, not just for the well itself, you know, which I know about from people like Tom and from explorations in Dúchastat, i.e. the Folklore Commission, but also in the landscape, because Idishuasal, or Church Island, is visible from here, just over the sallies. And that was a part of the rounds here. Tom will be able to tell you more about that than I do. That was mentioned by Taiga Muraku collecting folklore. So, you know, we were in Derrynane earlier, so Fionnán is there in that name. We see Inishuasal now, which he was particularly associated with. We have the Holy Well here. So I think it embodies, the landscape embodies Fionnán within itself, as other areas do, you know, the Corcaguina Peninsula, Breanan. So I think because those traditions are just about within living memory and just about capable of being saved, at least in memory, I think we need to go looking for that in the landscape.
Tom, when you think of St. Fionnán, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Well, I suppose he being the patron saint of the parish here, and that, and the stories I would mainly have come from my uncle who lived here and my grandmother, and they're telling me the stories of the patrons from the past. Like, they had really become very small, even in my youth. But going back 150 years, there would have been huge crowds here. And like they explained to me, that, like you mentioned there about the rounds and doing the rosaries with each. And the rounds were always done clockwise. And the link with Inishuasal and Church Island, then was they always said you should genuflect as you did the round where the water flowed out. And at that point, when we were taught to do the genuflection here, you were facing directly at Church Island. So that kind of connected up the link between the two places.
Yeah, the Fionnán's burial place.
You know, there are a number of Tubberinnans. There's, a lovely one over in the glen right beside Ballinnan. There was one which is almost gone now over on Valentia Island. There's one in towards Kenmare, and there's one on the far side of Drumhill. So, you know, within 15 miles as the eagle flies from here, there are five wells to Fionnán. There are waves that are said are town in Ine. So, you know, it's almost as if he created a landscape.
Tom, one very special happening here, of a special good luck indication.
My mother told me that one of the things, one of the rare features was that some of the people who did visit here experienced seeing a tiny little fish in the well. And she told me when she was a young girl of 9 or 10 years old, her mother, who was my grandmother, was very ill, and she came to the well to say prayers for her. And when she appeared in, normally when you came, you prayed, a lot of the people would take a drink from the well, and just as she was about to do that, she saw a tiny fish. And I did speak to one other lady from the locality who was also passed on by now, but she told me that she had seen the fish in the well. The well was associated with sort of healing for sight, so some of the people would rub the holy water to their eyes as well.
Paddy, so much gathering by a local man, folklore collector Taiga Muraku.
Yeah, Taiga Muraku is an extraordinary collector, you know, born in Shkehánach out the far side of Castle Cove, and lived most of his working life in Waterville, but he was possibly the most prolific collector for what was then the Irish Folklore Commission, now housed in UCD. And, you know, we had Éigsinnibrí Dóigh celebrating him 2 years ago. The richness that's in his work, a lot of it available online at dúchas.ie, and particularly the richness, which I hope will be published in his diaries, where he described where he went And he describes going into places where there were no roads at the time and walking in over the mountain into Clochuile, not too far from us, over the lake there, and coming home at 2 o'clock in the morning full of the stories he had heard.
Cures associated with St Finan here and many holy wells are to do with the eyes, as you said, Tom. Any curing here was kept very secret. Christ telling the man he cured, go and tell nobody. Tom, you have stories of a couple of cures here.
Well, I know of a lady who visited the well quite regularly, say even as recent as maybe 20 years ago, and she told me that there was an illness in her family, and she took the holy water, and when it was rubbed to the person who had this ailment, there was an almost immediate relief, and she repeatedly came back here over a period of 9 or 10 years and regularly took the holy water, and the person in her family who was very seriously ill lived for many a long day after that, and you know, lived for more than a decade after having been at a stage where there was a very serious illness. The traditional days were the 15th and 16th of March, and when people were coming here maybe 40 or 50 years ago, people from places like Ballinskelligs and Cathar Daniel and maybe further reaches of the Drummond Parish, they would only come on one day. But the custom was you'd come in, say your rosaries and do your rounds, and you'd have to walk down the road out of sight of the well and come back and do the second round, which would cover you for the second day.
There aren't many people coming to the well now, but it's still very well kept.
I mean, well, I suppose my brother lives here still, and he would tend to it from time to time and see after. But as I say, the custom of people coming on the 15th or 16th, there's only probably less than a handful nowadays who would still do that. Mm-hmm. And some of our own family members would visit it, all right. But like even when I was, you know, in my teens, there would have been at least 20 people coming regularly. That's 40 years ago, yeah. But that has dwindled away. But the other cause, as I said, it was a 2-day event, and at one stage then it became a 3-day event because of St. Patrick's Day being the 17th. Yeah. Some people used to come on 3 days.
Was there a celebration as well? Was there drinking and other things?
Well, I think in the early times there used to be a sort of a, you know, one of these taverns set up here, and there was a big number. There was hundreds of people, like in the mid-1800s. Right. And there's even a story my grandmother told me here out, as you just entered the well, there's a big rock. And that rock at one time went right across the road, like, and no car could get access to the house, or even it was only just barely for a horse to pass. And he decided back in the 1940s, after he came from America, that he would break up this rock to make the access easier. And his mother at the time had a big objection, because she said back around the time of the famine there was a murder took place here, a row that occurred during one of the patterns, and the body was laid out on that rock, and she said you shouldn't interfere with it. But he got the better of her anyway and took away 75% of it.
And there were no repercussions?
Not that I'm aware of anyway. Yeah.
The other great Finan site, not particularly for a holy well, but Leach Denain up on the side of Drung Hill, which was a Christianized tumulus. But first of all, it's the traditional boundary of Ivra. It's still a parish boundary. You look back from it towards Glenbey, you look out from it and you look down the Valentia Channel out to sea. It's an extraordinary dominant place. So it's almost as if, you know, you pass here, you're going into the territory of Finan. And, you know, he was a beneficent presence. He was known to have intervened with local kings who were treating their people badly, that sort of thing. There, you know, a wonderful life edited by Padraig O'Rean tells stories like that, as well as curing people of illnesses, particularly the plague. A poet from this area, 17th century poet Sean O'Connell, said, Finan lochaliach maneafsa a rug ivrahoch sair on blaiglish. My saint, Finan of Loch Leach, who kept Ivra safe from the plague.
Tom, thanks indeed for talking to us.
You're very welcome.
Thank
you too.
We mentioned earlier, we were talking up at Cumhachiste about Donal Bean O'Connell Queen, but welcoming O'Connell home, as we said, in 1828, after he won the Clare by-election and achieved Catholic emancipation. To sing us out to a break in the 10 o'clock news, Tim Dennehy sings Thomas Ruiz O'Sullivan's Donal Bean O'Connell Queen.
She don albino conel queen on the plown the field on the rail, Golefiao sefinis miau rechin, the skull she she's on creslocked. Go well she scrifa we balstorina, go mafar a kiss to rail, Skomegna firegi brackleffly tang tacht. Ishtachar fwinte chlerem Is un raid fal de dal dal Raid fal de dal dal Raid fal al de dal de deri Eni vora hoch ir ton dragun dian Arshgi edi horeran Govo kuriad go broch fochiach Un tol sio hein un eidem Fon is fiach o grog dian, gan ffoil yr iasog sgleipem. Fwy hoel yn diel angrog lir, ach plo is pian gor embam. Is yn rhaid ffal dy dal dal, rhaid ffal dy dal dal, rhaid ffal al dy dal dy deri. En son of war, shachun, shachohem port, la glore anu der nefa, beg shor, shaduk an chron, gan chlo, gan solas bord, gan feistam. All hem lon is a bior le faun, is kohainem chun dan reilen, beg broga duar gachogar chlul, kegroan de huin. Gan eg meis Es an raid fal dal dal Raid fal dal dal Raid fal al dal de deri Beng na ministeri gan stras gan fimp S'ni reid chum ar a heidis Ni wened y cist an a catla cydd Mar cyr for sys na merling Beg don a lachwi ham er a di Gong lan for creen a se
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry Brought to you by the new family fish box at Quinlan Seafood Bars Packed with golden fish goujons, fresh squid, delicious prawns and tasty homemade chips. Order yours to take away today.
And the boys of a bonus lady who hunted farther and
in our pilgrimage to Paddy Bush's special places, based on his great book, The Amargan Step, An Exploration of the Imagination of Iveragh. Today's programme was recorded on April the 29th. For future programmes, your story on Paddy Bush's exploration of his special places. Write Frank Lewis, Gillon, Mangerton Road, Muckross, Killarney. Email franklewismangerton@gmail.com. Text 083-300-3300 or phone 066-712-3666 with your name and address for use on air. In this second hour, in Derrynan, the Meadow Walk was revived, Daniel O'Connell, and was celebrated by his poet daughter, Ellen. Artok Dana, the monument inspired by An Leabhar Gaeilge, the Book of Invasions, and the Amargan's story of the first discovery of Ireland. The Ecta Chua Gallon stones that have a midwinter alignment. And to begin, we're at Derrynan House, the place that celebrates and commemorates the greatest Kerryman, the greatest Irishman of the past hundreds of years, where we're joined by Declan Moran, who's a guide at Derrynan House. We're actually in the dining room of the house, surrounded by O'Connell, and his daughter Ellen is just behind my back of the portraits around me here. Declan, as well as great celebration, this place experienced terrible tragedy. The story of O'Connell's aunt, Eileen Duvney Connell, and her love of Art O'Leary.
An absolute tragedy it was. Eileen had been married previously. She was married as a 15-year-old, sent off to marry an O'Connor of Fyarees, and that's as much as we know about him, other than the fact that he was in his 70s, and the marriage didn't last very long, 6 months. She managed to escape that one and made her way to see her sister, actually, in Macroom in Cork. And on one fine day, she spotted Art O'Leary on his horse in the square in Macroom and fell in love at first sight. They were married. They married against the wishes of Huntingcap, which a few generations of the O'Connell families found to their detriment doesn't really go too well, including Daniel himself. So they married in secret, and they were kind of disowned, I suppose, by Huntingcap and the family. Mm-hmm. And of course, as foreseen by Huntingcap, it ended in tragedy on the 4th of May 1773. He was a Catholic who had created a few eruptions amongst the Protestant ascendancy. He had fallen out with him with the local magistrate called Abraham Morris, and he outlawed him. So he was actually murdered in Carriganimma on that day. And the horse, by as the story goes, spun back to the house where in Raleigh House where Eileen and was with her children, and out she came to see the bloodied horse, jumped on its back and went back to her dying husband, where she composed the beginning, I suppose, at least, of the of Queen Na Carta Léire. Now, it is a great mystery to me. It's one of my great mysteries in the O'Connell family, is to find out where Eileen ended up.
Paddy, longing to be here in Derrynane, wanting to stay here, but at the same time the demands to be away, and very much wanting to be part of what was going on there as well.
Yeah, I mean, he was somebody who, by instinct, by personal preference, would have stayed in Derrynane happily hunting, but he was somebody by conviction, and I imagine a certain amount of personality, he had to be in the midst of things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was in a time when that meant uprooting your life and staying in Dublin or staying in London, wherever the case may be. So, you know, September seems to have been a sacred month to him. He came to Derrynane at that time, and other times he could, but it informed all his thinking, and he was very much influenced by the kind of thought we get in Wordsworth, that landscape influences people, almost has a moral effect on them, and that sense of grandeur and power, and that is so much part of the mountain landscape and seascape of Ivrea, is I think affected his political views, his sense of power transferring itself to the people who lived among that landscape.
You also quote vitriolic attack on him, quoted in verse in the Times of London. Do you see the piece there?
Scum condensed of Irish bog, coward, liar, demagogue, and so forth. I suppose it's been a long time since there's been an editorial in poetry in any newspaper that I know of. But it does show you, at one level, the kind of invective that was common. You know, it wasn't invented with Donald Trump. It was quite common in the 19th century, and O'Connell was well able to dish it out himself. But it does show, you know, scum condensed of Irish bog, meant as an insult. You know, even to this day, people talk about bog men and bog Latin and bog standard. But in fact, to my mind, it was summing up O'Connell's greatness, that he was condensed of his people, that he knew the bog people, he knew every level of society. Mm-hmm. And in that way, he was able to harness that, the power of that. Mm-hmm. He was a populist before the word populist, or the idea of populist, became a bit degraded as it is now. But O'Connell was a supreme populist, and therein lay his power.
Declan, the duel you referred to a minute ago that profoundly changed O'Connell's life.
It occurred in 1815. Around the same time as the portrait we look at was painted, actually. Now, he had refused a few duels at this stage, and his sons had fought a couple of duels on his behalf. So I think at the time he had no other choice but to agree to this duel with John de Stair. Now, he had insulted Dublin Corporation at the time. He had called him a beggarly corporation, which was one of the mildest insults that O'Connell had ever used for anything. But John de Stair decided to take exception to this, as he was facing bankruptcy himself. It also helped that he was the number one crack shot in Dublin Corporation. So it was a great opportunity for them to get rid of their problem. Unfortunately for them, they didn't know that O'Connell was a crack shot himself, from, as Paddy would have mentioned, plenty of the hunting that he had done over the years. Mm-hmm. Around here. So the duel took place in Kildare in February 1st, 1815. O'Connell would have shot low, possibly to injure or miss, but the bullet hit this day around the hip area, and he died of blood loss 3 days later. Now, being the gentleman at the word of time, he had forgiven O'Connell even before he died, and O'Connell offered an allowance to this day's widow, which she refused but accepted on behalf of her daughters, which he paid until he died himself. John de Stair's wife ended up marrying into the Guinness family herself.
Looking at a piece of silver commissioned by the Catholic Board at a cost of 1,000 guineas and presented to O'Connell in thanks for his defence of newspaper owner John McGee.
He used the trial to turn it into a defence of the people. He knew he was going to lose this, sedition trial. Mm-hmm. So he said, "You heard our detractors calumniate us." And he said, "You listened to them with great patience. Listen now to our vindication." And with that, he launched into a tirade against the abusive, oppressive rule, partly religious-based, partly nationality-based. So the McGee trial, although McGee was convicted, was a triumph for O'Connell and really the thing that catapulted him into national leadership.
Mm. Wasn't it an extraordinary contrast? At a time when people were starving, people were in a bad way, spending 1,000 guineas... on this piece of silverware to present to O'Connell.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is one of the things that is said against O'Connell. O'Connell was not a social radical, and it's one of the reasons more left-wing activists and historians have questioned him. He didn't the basis of society, but it was very common at the time. And, you know, if we look at the world today and what's being spent on ballrooms in the White House and, you know, the inequality, I think, is even greater today.
The best kind of family triumph from a memoir by his son John in 1848, Paddy.
Yes, after the 1832 election. "Early in the forenoon of Tuesday, the 5th of February, 1833, my father led what might have been called his household brigade, that is, his three sons and two sons-in-law, down to the House of Commons to be present at the opening of the first Reform Parliament, of which all six had just been elected members."
Extraordinary, wasn't it? I mean, six members only.
Yeah, well, there are certain Kerry dynasties that reflect that in some way nowadays.
I mean, 5 years after the 1828 election, having six of them.
It was extraordinary from just O'Connell himself. And, you know, you mentioned Ellen and her poetry. Her great poem, Derry Nan, in 1832, that we'll be talking about, was in fact a piece of propaganda in that election campaign. You know, it was a very fine poem as well, but it was a piece of electioneering propaganda.
Declan, before we leave you, I mean, the Donnerail conspiracy, the marathon ride from Derrynan to Cork, it's extraordinary.
That's one version of it, yes. I think the marathon ride particularly came the other direction from John Burke, who came, it was John, I think, yeah, that took off at 5 o'clock on a Saturday evening and promised that he'd be down in Derrynan by 9 o'clock on Sunday morning, and he duly arrived to O'Connell and went to Mass at 9 o'clock every morning in the chapel here. Four had been convicted already, so and there was 20 more, I think, to go on trial. So this was in 1830, so O'Connell really was no longer really a practicing barrister at that stage. He was a fully-fledged politician at that stage, but he agreed to take the case, and he took off for Cork in the carriage and arrived at late. They actually they tried to get a delay on the trial, and it was refused. A few tactical delays started taking place in the courtroom to allow O'Connell to make his entrance, which he duly did, and by all accounts ate his breakfast in the courtroom after arriving, before going on to duly win the case for the Donnerail conspirators.
Fantastic. Declan, thanks indeed for talking to us. We're going to move on, and we'll visit another of Paddy's special places in a few minutes.
And the boys of a Bognes Loidy who hunted for the land.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars, located across Kerry. Enjoy a simple, healthy and easy dinner solution with Quinlan's fresh, ready-made seafood meals. Available in store.
And the boys of a Bognes Loidy who hunted for the land.
In our pilgrimage to Paddy Bush's special places, guided by his unique book, The Amargan Step, An Exploration in the Imagination of Iveragh, we're now on the Meadow Walk that revived O'Connell. Leaving Derrynane House, Paddy, you went in search of the Meadowalk that you found mentioned in a poem by O'Connell's daughter Ellen, a published poet, but not one whose reputation has survived the test of time. Read the verse that set you off.
I climbed the beach, and passing quickly by the mansion house, that most irregular but picturesque and striking pile, again the antique garden with its terraces and avenue of venerable trees, thence wander forth into the meadow walk.
In this exploration of the imagination, this was a place that you discovered had been unknown for we don't know how long.
Well, had been forgotten about, the name, the meadow walk. I asked members of the O'Connell family when I came across this, had they ever heard of the meadow walk? I think I asked James and other people working here, and no, they hadn't. But eventually I did what I should have done first, looked at the old original ordnance survey maps, and there was a footpath marked on them that seemed to, you know, answer Ellen's description of the meadow walk would be in roughly the right place. There was no sign of that footpath now, but with James's help, I then came to James and we both started following, you know, where we thought it would go. And then when we came to this particular place we're in, we realised, I think, we were on the right track.
Because you saw some evidence here of...
Yeah, on the map, it marked footstick, which is a very simple form of bridge. There's no wooden structure, but there are the remains of a stone foundation on the far bank. It's also on the near bank, and that mirrored exactly what was on the map, and that mirrored Ellen's description of it. So, it, you know, the pathway was actually hiding in plain sight in those original ordnance survey maps.
Yeah. James, some of that avenue of venerable trees are still to be seen today, 200 years after Ellen wrote her poem.
Yes, and all the beech trees that were planted quite often on estates, you know, and obviously O'Connell's had also planted an avenue of them at the start of the end of the garden and the start of the meadow walk. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking that those trees look as if they're almost at the end of their time, which would make them around 300 years as the outset of how old they get. Mm-hmm. And they would have been about 100 years old, we'd say, at a guess, that time. And a 100-year-old beech tree can be quite a sight, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a matured, early immaturity, but it's still a big tree.
And unvenerable trees, a fine oak here, attempts to propagate a whole field of oaks by the meadow walk now.
Yes, well, we did plant a whole field of them, but I couldn't get acorns enough here at that time, so Cormac Foley got them in Killarney.
But you had a fine mast here. Was it last year or...?
Yeah, we had a huge mass, well, everywhere, but yeah. Here I saw hundreds and hundreds of them, so I did collect quite a lot, and I have them sprouting now. I had planned to hand them to the school, hoping kids would be interested in planting them at home, but perhaps we could hand them over to here and plant them out.
Paddy, in finding this meadow walk, you were guided by O'Neill Daunt, who writes, "The meadow walk, which crosses and recrosses a merry mountain brook. In contrast, Ellen's poem tells a rude path winding along the verge of a wild mountain torrent."
Yeah, I thought they were contradictory until a few times, sometimes with James, when we were investigating and establishing the path. You know, a day like today, you'd walk across and hardly get your feet wet. There were other days you wouldn't cross it because it would knock you. It mightn't drown you, but it would certainly knock you. And when you think of where the stream comes from up Cathairnigoighe Mountain, you know, heavy days rain, certainly three or four heavy days rain, and what's coming gently by here now would be a mountain torrent.
James, do you have a story about a child's swing? And no.
Yeah, well, Paddy says in the book that we came across a swing hanging on the beech tree just there.
Just across the street,
yes.
There, yeah.
And these kids had a hideout there and a swing, and they'd been taking materials from our depot. So I followed them one day and, you know, said, "Oh, where did you get that stuff and that?" And they explained that they were all apologetic and everything. But anyway, I found out who they were. And they were the great, 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 great grandchildren of Daniel O'Connell. So, but I didn't say it to Paddy at the time, which I ought to have, but it slipped my mind at the time. So there is a connection, isn't there, in a way, to...
Yeah, I think it's a lovely connection.
Fantastic.
You know, Ellen talked about her children playing here and, you know, that the grandchildren or great-great, however many greats there were, of other descendant of O'Connell were playing here as well. There is, you know, even though it's a place in state control, there's a remarkable continuity of O'Connell's that's still felt around the place and, if you like, has been consolidated, I think, by the state control.
James, I mean, from a child's world to the serious adult business of how Daniel O'Connell's ancestors made their money, interesting discoveries in recent years.
Well, you mean the smuggling?
Of course.
If we can call
was there
that.
Another?
Unregulated
trading sounds far better. No, but we often thought the Cashel, where in the parklands there,
yeah.
We always assumed they stored their goods there. But there was only a smallish souterrain, which would hardly have stored much. But when it was being done up and done, the archaeologist, he found a new souterrain there that was hidden from view, and it was a fine size, you know, quite long and the height of a man. Mm-hmm. So it could have stored barrels upon the barrels, I'm sure, of the finest wines and brandy. But as it happens, he had hoped to find something in there after he discovered it, and all he found was a football and an empty packet of tato crisps that had obviously gone in an outlet in the walls down low, you know, that had space just for small things to blow in. So, unfortunately, no sign of anything else.
Yeah. Paddy, the mountainous boundaries of Iveragh, we talked about a minute ago, had personal advantages for the O'Connells, and again for their, as you say, illicit activity.
Yeah. Even today, you know, there are only three routes really into here. And, you know, when you're in a car on a modern contoured road, you don't know them. But if you walk the Kerry Way, you realise, you know, what a self-contained area bounded by a semicircle of mountains from Drung Hill down to, you know, a little bit west or east of here. The O'Connells were in an area that was one of the last places to be anglicised. It was one of the last places the Normans reached in Ireland. So they thrived as a family, having been dispossessed of their possessions during the Cromwellian Wars. They thrived for a aristocratic Catholic family almost as well as they could have been.
Paddy, are you suggesting that the Meadow Walk and the area around Derrynane House was a much more extensive garden in O'Connell's time?
Well, certainly the practical aspects of the garden would have been much larger. It would have been feeding a very large amount of people. What now appears as a leisure garden was probably full of spuds. They were largely self-sufficient in their food. Mm-hmm. And certainly a lot of the woodland near the Meadow Walk has just grown that way since it became a national park back in the 1960s. The original Meadow Walk bounded ornamental gardens and woodland, but the far side of it, where you now see young woodland, was open fields.
I always claimed that when I was doing the garden first, in the upper lawn, we could still see the sign of the old potato all through, you know, the ridges, mm-hmm. all through the garden, and the other half was orchard, so that was the standard of the time, I'm sure. Vegetables in half where the garden is, and orchard in the other half, and a glasshouse down at the end. I don't know if they ever had too much of an ornamental garden, only for the introduction of ornamental trees. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that story I tell of the turkey oak that was planted supposedly by O'Connell himself.
James, thanks for talking to us.
A pleasure.
We move on.
And the boys of a Bogness Lloyde, who hunted farther and
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Take the fear out of fish and chat to our fishmongers about how to add delicious, easy-to-cook seafood into your menu. Oven and air fryer-ready meals available.
And the boys of a Bognes Loidy, who hunted farther and.
In touching on Paddy Bush's special places, his exploration in the imagination of Iveragh, recorded on April the 29th, your tale on Paddy's places for future programmes, text 083 300 3300 or phone 066 71 23666. We're now at Arachdana Memorial Monument along the seafront in the middle of Waterville. Arachdana vessel focus on 6 meters high prow of a Viking-like boat, only a fringe of the body of the vessel overground. That part, like a boat buried in the sand in Ross Bay and Ballyhaig, with a whole lot of subtle detail. We're joined by the monument's sculptor, Holger Lunds. The sculptor, Holger Lunds, sees the piece remembering the first people to come to live in Ireland. Paddy, read your poem, Amargan's Ship.
Amargan's Ship for Holger Lunds. Because he wanted simply to be as one with the swelling wave and the wind, with the salmon and with the stars clustered in the eye of the gannet. He sailed north when the four winds blossomed together in a compass, north being the petal that trembled towards the grey, ambiguous headlands the elder swore he scried from the tower, infinitely far beyond the salty horizon. The ship's skin-lined planking breathed brine and wind, welded gust and swell in a coupling that surpassed navigation. Sea and ship hammered one another into one another, shaped wind and weather to the poet's will, to be the voyage, to be the landfall, and the words that marked the landfall, to be the land and the land's creatures, to be the stones raised in commemoration, to be the ship beached forever on the land, and the words singing themselves into bronze.
Holger, where did the inspiration come from?
The brief was to do something with Amargan, and it was commissioned by Kerry County Council. And instead of looking at a kind of historical or rather mythological figure of Amargan, I was more interested in commemorating the navigators who have come to this shore and possibly from northern Spain in the prehistoric times, anything from the Mesolithic to the Bronze Age to the Iron Age. And the monument itself really represents the different means of navigation which were available to the sailors in those days.
Paddy, Holger's sculpture leads you to a whole reflection on Lár Gála Éireann, the Book of the Invasions of Ireland, which you describe as an account of the early story of Ireland written at a much later time with a certain agenda.
Yes, it was, you know, obviously there were fragments of it, but it was written to establish a lineage and a distinguished lineage for the Gaelic people who were the establishment in Ireland. So the Lár Gála tied it in with biblical narratives. Remember, it was written down in the time of monks, dealing with the pre-Christian times, but they tied it in and they built it on stories that actually seem to have originated in Spain from the, I think, 6th century Bishop Isidora of Sevilla, whose interest was to show that Spain had spread Christianity and civilization, and the story travelled to Ireland. So it may have some factual basis. There certainly would have been trading routes, but the guiding thing was to give a distinguished history to the Gaelic people, and that was rejuvenated then by Seachrún Caitin in Forest Fasar Éireann, by Sean O'Connell in his local poem Tirriban na hÉireann, and was even, you know, affected modern nationalism. I remember being told the history in primary school, as was in Lár Gála, much as if it were the factual history of the country.
Holger, the sculpture is made of bronze using the ancient Is it Repoussé process?
So usually the monuments you see around as public sculptures, they're cast bronze. So they're molded first, they're modeled, they're molded, and then cast in bronze. But it's a very wasteful process because there's a lot of energy lost and a lot of waste material. So years back, I switched to a process called the Repoussé process, which goes back to the late Bronze Age, early Iron Age in Ireland. And you basically use a sheet metal and you anneal it, you soften it by heating it up until it's kind of glowing red. And then whenever it's cool, you basically hammer it into the shape. And I've combined that with a modern process of TIG welding, so I can do small sheets, weld them together over kind of a stainless steel structure, and that's what we see here at Arachdana.
Paddy, Lár Gaoilge Éireann suggests that Ireland's early story was peaceful because first and succeeding invaders got on with one another. You suggest this was an important lesson for us today.
Yeah, some people would say it should be better known rather than Book of Invasions as Book of Possession and Repossession. And, you know, the Book of Invasions as a title came about in the 19th century when European powers were highly imperial, when invasion and conquest and subjection was a respectable political narrative. And what I love about Amargin's poem in particular is the fact that he came ashore, possibly just behind our backs here, and instead of saying, "I'm claiming the land," he said, "I'm the wind on the sea, I'm the wave on the shore, I'm the hawk on the cliff, I'm the salmon in the pool." There was an identification with the land, and particularly when, you know, the world is facing an ecological crisis. If we identify with the natural world rather than see it as something to be exploited, made money from, you know, a lot of our problems would disappear if we realise that every time we wound the world, we're wounding ourselves. I think it would disappear. So on a symbolic level, and that's, you know, I'm not saying Amargin was a prehistoric hippie, but on a symbolic level, that thing of saying a place is something we belong to, which we share with other creatures, which imagines us, that we'll maybe have a different thing rather than the extractive, exploitative process that has left us in, you know, not just a problematic situation, but an existential crisis that we're in.
Holger, there's a lot of thought behind Arachdana. And it's set, of course, in the middle of a sundial. I mean, as I can see, it's now showing that it's 12:30.
It is, but it's winter time. We have the summer time. So it can only set to one, obviously.
Paddy, exploring in the imagination of Ivra, what was your aim?
Well, I was really, rather than aiming at something, I was describing a process, you know, which I had gone through, you know, began a couple of years after I moved here when I found out I knew nothing about Amargin or Amargin's poem or very little about the Miletian. You know, when I found out how much that was entwined with the history of the place, the imagination of the place, and then discovering other stories. Like, I mean, fairly soon after I arrived here, I came to the conclusion there were three enormous stories that appealed to me. One was the Miletians. The other was not just Daniel O'Connell, but his whole family as a literary and political phenomenon. And the other was Skellig Mhí Chathair. And they helped me to relate to the place. And it's a kind of spiritual experience. I don't have religious belief in the normal sense. For me, spirituality means imagining yourself into the minds of others, particularly those who have gone before us, how they felt, how they thought about a place, how the place influenced them. And then the place becomes enriched for you, and that enriches your life, I think.
Holger, thanks indeed for talking to us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And the boys of a Bognes Loidy, who hunted farther and...
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Supplement your diet with a healthy and fresh dinner option. Fresh seafood from Quinlan's.
And the boys of
of a bog, Miss Lloydy. Who hunted farther and.
And now the last in this selection of Paddy Bush's special places, based on his explanation in The Imagination of Ivara, the Amagan Step. We're now on a low hill just outside Waterville, beside four, roughly 7.5 metre, 25 foot overall length, the tallest 2.7 metres high megalithic pillars, four of them altogether, aligned towards the southwest, looking down on Loch Curran, Loch Ligdach. Here, we're again joined by the populariser of archaeology in Ivara, John Sheehan. The Gaelic Irish, the last invaders, apart from the Norse English, created our own story. But Paddy, while you describe this as mythology, but your book reveals the mythology has a lot of facts about Ivara.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned Loch Ligdach there, which was the older name for the lake, and that is the specific geographical reference that grounds the Milesians landing here, because most of the other place names, you know, or most of the other areas are described rather than named. But it was also a place that, because of that association, Gaelic clans traced their origin back to. And, you know, the whole Loch Ligdach is a bit like the Plymouth Rock in America. You know, the older families liked to say this was their origin. So, you know, that's the primary importance in mythology, and I stress it's mythology.
John, why are Iachtarcuaigh Ghlan stones the most popular stone alignment in Ivara?
Well, I suppose it's because of geography. We're only 200 or 300 metres from the Ring of Kerry Road. They're highly visible. Anybody passing, going in whichever direction along there, look up and they'll see these fingers sticking up on the top of the little hill that we're standing on. So that's one reason. But people who know a bit more about the traditions of Ivara, or who read about Ivara, will also know there's another depth of significance to the stones. And that is that it's believed locally that Scéanna, the wife of Amargan, who died on the voyage from Spain to Ireland, was buried here.
You're looking down at a lake that was hugely important to the economic life of the area. I mean, tourism in Waterville grew up primarily around fishing. The name itself, An Curann for Waterville, is actually named after the salmon pool, which a curra was a pool. So the salmon is mentioned a lot. It's mentioned in relation to Amargan. First thing he does is charm salmon into the bay and the lake. Stories about Finan are full of salmon. So, you know, it's a reflection of the culture, the possession of the areas over a long period and over a period of language change.
Mm. John, our ancestors of some 4,000 years ago went to a lot of trouble erecting these stones.
These alignments of stones, these stone rows, when you find them in various parts of Ireland, always are northeast-southwest. They're facing the southwest, the setting sun. And it's a bit like what we were speaking about earlier on in the Wedge Tomb. The southwest is the area of the descending sun. The sun disappears there. It's the area of death.
This is pointing to the midwinter setting of the sun. And you make the point that, okay, it's the last of the declining light. It's the beginning of new light.
Yeah, it's a nervous time. If you think of midwinter in pre-literate societies, the days are getting shorter. There is the promise of spring and the promise of longer days. But when is it going to happen? It's probably also a time when stocks of foodstuffs are getting low and so on. So it's a time when people are nervous and anticipating in hope that better days are to come. So they want to mark that turning point.
In Ishuasal, or Church Island, which is also aligned with this stone row, there's a cell, the remains of a cell from post-1000 AD, Greland Rourke says, and the same phenomenon can be seen there. There is a tunnel built into the wall of that thing, and the same setting sun on which these Bronze Age standing stones are aligned shines into that cell. And nowadays the roof is gone, but if the roof were still there, it would have illuminated the darkness. And that was around Christmas, and that in the Christian tradition, that's the birth of Christ. So the death is also birth. And, you know, I think that ties in with what John was saying, that it's the disappearance of something, something new coming, regeneration. And, you know, that's the pattern of life. And all sorts of religions, all beliefs try to mark that.
John, you want to...
Yeah, I think it's important to say that Paddy, what Paddy has just said about Inis Uasail, Church Island, and his discovery of this sun's ray that goes in to St Finan's cell, that's actually very important. It hadn't been noted until recent years when Paddy began to observe it. And it's important in the sense that we have a Christian, probably 10th century or thereabouts is when that cell was built. And I remember when we first went out to survey that cell and to describe it 30 years ago, we were able to describe it and survey it, but we couldn't explain what it was because there was nothing like it in any other Christian site in Ireland. It was a very strange building.
In what way?
The shape of it, the size of it, the orientation of it, it's clearly not a church or anything like that. The fact it had this very low aperture at the base, which made no sense. Now it makes sense because that's where the sun comes in, we now know. The fact it's oriented on the same event as this prehistoric standing stone, just what? Is it a mile away as the crow flies, Paddy?
Even less.
Yeah. That you have two events from two totally different religions, two totally different cultures over very different centuries focused on more or less the same event, one to do with death, one to do with rebirth. Yeah. And it also demonstrates, to me at any rate, the strong likelihood that the monks... or their secular patrons who funded the building of St Finian's cell were aware of the importance of this phenomenon here at Ithacua and wanted to harness it and be associated with it in some way. And therefore it's important to note that when Michael Connolly was excavating here, he got some radiocarbon dates around the stones and around the enclosure here beside it, and some of them are early medieval in date, 7th century up to 10th, 11th century. So there was activity here in that period, more or less at the same time as this unique monument was being built on Church Island.
Paddy, the dúlúthar, the winter gloom, your working of the word suggests that it might more correctly mean dark winter tempered by a promise of light. You write, poetry also can be, I hope, a defence against encroaching darkness, threatens me with debilitating depression. I crave some ritual lifting of my inner darkness. Over Christmas and into the 2018 New Year, a poem took shape. You might read it.
Dúlúthar, thin rushlight, barely enough to huddle around a word that bears such a weight of darkness. Black rushes, dark light of the year, whose turning is fearfully hoped for. The dark of this stone row marks the sun's deepest down descent, behind the mountain horizon, distant beyond any measure that we know, who know only to gather around hope and hold close our circled rushlights, finding little spurts of warmth in words.
John, does archaeology have that kind of emotional impact on you?
I can remember once, I was in the Bride Valley, and I was on my own doing field work, and I was high up, and in the part of the valley that I was in, there was nothing marked on the archaeological maps, there was nothing marked on the Ordnance Survey maps, but I got this sense that there was something there, and I hung on into the evening, and I walked around. It was a lovely day, it was like today, it was really warm and all that, and I was wandering around, and then I saw this big stone. There were lots of stones, there were hundreds of stones, but I saw this particular one, and something told me that's the stone, and I walked over to it, climbed up on it because it was quite high up, and the top of it was covered in rock art. Beautiful Bronze Age rock art. Now, I said to myself, this is lucky. I bet you if I look at all the other stones, they'll be covered in rock art. And I did. I spent another hour looking at all the other stones. Not a single one was covered in rock art. This one was. And it was so difficult to find that I had to take off my shirt and put it on the stone and put a stone on top of it so I would be able to find it again the next day so we could draw it. You were asking me about getting emotional. I felt very emotional. I don't know what I felt. Did a higher power, did some Bronze Age god lead me to that stone? did something want me to discover it? It sounds crazy now. I'm beginning to feel a bit sorry that I'm mentioning it, but you did ask. But when I walked away shirtless from that stone that evening, I could not explain how I found that site.
Amazing. Paddy Bush's Special Places. Read the full, fascinating, layering away the story of Ivara through the book. That will be a collector's piece, The Amargan Step, an exploration in the imagination of Ivara. Special congratulations and thanks to Paddy Bush and all of those who joined us. My thanks to programme coordinator, looked after location sound, Siobhan Lewis, and Alan O'Brien, who executed post-production. From me, Frank Lewis, until the last Saturday in June, the 27th, when we will delve into the story of another amazing place. Until then, the cuckoo is still singing. The dawn chorus is still special. The brilliance and flush of spring is melding into the rich decadence of summer. A time to be in the outdoors, to swim in ocean, lake and river, but take care of yourselves. You are special to many people. Thanks for your company. Pat Kelly will be with you after the news. And now to play us out.
Oh, the town it climbs the mountain and looks upon the sea. At sleeping time or waking time, 'tis there I'd like to be. To walk again those kindly streets.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars, located across Kerry. Because at least one day of the weekend should involve someone else doing all the cooking. Order your delicious takeaway from Quinlan's today.